Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are in the world. I hope you're very well. You're listening to Autistic Voices on UK Health Radio. I'm Evelyn Charmer. I'm a paediatric therapist and I'm the director of Ed Elf Child Therapy Limited and its sister training company for therapists, the Child Hypnotherapy Institute. And I've recently been diagnosed autistic myself. So I'm very inspired to bring you a diverse and rich range of autistic voices from the community. People who are diagnosed, people who are not diagnosed, people who work alongside and collaborate with autistic families or autistic adults, people who identify as neurodivergent. Please come and join the conversation. I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at Evelyn, that's EvaLynne, at childhypnotherapyinstitute.com, or contact me via the show. Thank you for joining me with Autistic Voices on UK Health Radio. Hello, welcome to the show, listeners. I'm Evelyn Charmer. This is Autistic Voices on UK Health Radio. I hope you're all fine and dandy out there in this lovely September that we're having. I've got a lovely man on the show today. He's an SEND or SEND specialist living in Pudsey on the edge of Leeds. His name's Gary Freeman. So welcome to the show, Gary.
Welcome, Evelyn. And thank you for having me on today. Hello, everybody.
Hello, everybody. Yeah. So I know we have a lot of listeners who might be parents and carers, and they've got children who are, you know, either diagnosed or waiting for diagnoses and all of those sorts of things, or waiting for education healthcare plans, who are in the SEND, Special Educational Needs and Disabilities kind of system. So we're going to talk a lot about that today, which is really topical, especially as schools and colleges have just gone back.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, but we'll start with how I always start the show, which is gratitude. So what I'm grateful for today, this show has been recorded in advance of it going out. And actually, it's been recorded on the 9th of September. So most people will be aware by now that our Queen Elizabeth died yesterday. And so my thoughts go out to all of her family and loved ones at this time. And she had a great innings and lived to a ripe old age, but that makes no difference when you lose a loved one and a mother. And she was a wonderful figure. So I guess I am grateful to still have my mum with me. And her health hasn't been amazing over the past few years, but she's still with us. So if you're listening in, mum, hello, and love you very much. So heart goes out to mothers today. What are you grateful for, Gary?
I'm grateful in a very similar vein for all the people that I have around me, and particularly immediate family and close friends. I'm also really grateful for the fact that I can enjoy the world around me as well. I'm able to do that because that's such an important part of my life. And I think if you put the two together, it's about being grateful for the whole environment of my life. Mm-hmm. I love the area that we live in, which is right on the edge of the Yorkshire Downs. I love the fact that family all seem to enjoy living around this area. We all take advantage of that as often as we can. The fact that I listen to music, a varied taste, but I'm able to enjoy that music. I'm able to share that enjoyment of music with members of the family. It's all part to me, like I say, of the environment that we live in, both the physical environment and the human environment. And I think it's so important to me that the two go together. Mm-hmm. I am really grateful for that.
Yeah, I can tell. Comes across. So thank you for that. So talking about your life, your environment, you have spent probably what has led partly to what you're doing now. You spent 43 years teaching.
I began teaching in 1977 which coincidentally, seems you mentioned the Queen, was her 25th silver
It was the
anniversary.
Jubilee. I
It
remember
was
we
the
had.
Jubilee. But I began teaching in that year, so the world has changed a great deal. I've moved around a little bit, but within a certain area. So I've taught in West Yorkshire, Leeds, Bradford, Calderdale. And I suppose I did what many people did and do, which is I looked for posts which reflected my interests. And that sort of pushed me in the direction of special needs.
Right.
I got into that by being a head of humanities faculty. And everything just sort of followed on from there. And that was 30 years ago now. And then from there, a wider interest developed. So I began to be involved in working with other schools, advising them from there into work with organizations such as NASEN. I've been involved in various projects at local authority level for the DfE. It all began with that move 30 years ago to what I thought at the time was a really challenging school in lots of different ways. But I benefited from it in terms of my own development, personally and professionally. And I feel, honestly, that the young people, the children, the families that I've worked with, and the professionals that I've worked with have also benefited. Yeah, it's 43 years in full-time employment as a teacher.
Which you're not doing now, just to be clear. You've moved,
Absolutely, yeah.
yeah. Well, you wouldn't have time to now because now you're an SEND consultant and advisor for people. So,
Correct.
wh who are you work? Who do who comes to you? Who sort? Who do you work with? What sort of things are they bringing?
Basically, I suppose I could say that anyone who comes to me for help, advice, guidance, information, it's predominantly parents and schools, increasingly multi-academy trusts. The schools are of all different kinds, maintained, academy free, independent, specialist. But it's the fact that there is that variety in my work, and it's that variety of and the huge range of people that I work with and support, which adds a great deal of enjoyment to me, enjoyment of the role, because no 2 days, it's very much like teaching, no 2 days are the same. No group of people that I work with is the same. But it is a it's an interesting role. It's a challenging one. It's one that gets me thinking. But I meet such fascinating people, committed professionals, ones who want to really make a difference at all different points of their career. Some are far more experienced, some are just new to the role of a Senko or a leader in some way in school. But they've all got that in common, that drive to make things better.
So what are the key issues that you are finding coming to you from either schools or parents and carers at the moment or other professionals?
I think there's a number of those. And there are some differences between the key issues for parents and families on one hand, and those for schools and professionals on the other. There is overlap as well. So I think one thing is there is this sense that children and young people with young adults, let's not forget young adults, with special or additional needs, have a right to receive what is appropriate for them. And I think that is what pulls people together. And it's what I certainly use to try and to encourage people to cooperate, collaborate on the basis of that sort of, it's become a bit hackneyed now, but that phrase of co-productive work that was first used in the reforms of 2014. With parents, it's obviously a sense more and more in my role of a sense of frustration of things not being done, not being provided. And surely professionals can see this or that, or why can't they understand this or that? And then it's for me, it's often about supporting the parents, but also helping them to understand the context in which schools operate. And the context in which local authorities operate, the fact that we can achieve things and we can get to the same goal but perhaps by slightly different routes. I used to talk about that when I developed a leading nurture system, and I talked about those children ending up with tremendously positive impacts, as we talk about for other young people with exam qualifications, for example, but getting there by different routes. And I believe the same thing when I'm working with parents and schools. We can end up at the same result and impact, which is hopefully positive for their children. But parents and schools might go slightly different ways. And for me, it's about bringing them together.
Okay.
Which is why I talked about the overlap. So for parents, it's very often about frustration. For schools and school-based professionals, in a sense, it's also about frustration, but caused by different things. It's caused very often by the frustration of they want to help children, young people, families, but they either don't know how to do it or they're unsure as to exactly how to do it. They've got an inkling, they've got an idea, or they feel that the resources aren't there from somewhere else. And in turn, when I work with any local authority officers, and I do have regular meetings with various local authority officers, I get the sense that it's the same for them. So there are lots of demands on various groups which hold them back, I think. This is my personal take on it, on experience, yes, which hold them back from providing what they really want to do. Which I think we can probably cover at some other point in this discussion is a systemic thing, perhaps.
Yeah.
But those are the key issues for me. You can unpick all of that. Is it about the provision that's actually in place in a classroom? Well, it is sometimes, but there's lots of ways that we can address that and look at it. Is it about funding? Is it about the way that professionals reach out to parents and how welcoming they are to parents and families? Well, again, it's that. All of those things come under the umbrella that I've been mentioning, which is it's a sense of frustration.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose to bring that together, what I try and do is to show people and support them in how you actually engage with each other in a productive way, whilst at the same time challenging each other, but in what I would like to call a co-productive challenge, not an antagonistic challenge, not an aggressive challenge, not even an adversarial challenge, but a co-productive one. And I just find that works.
Yeah.
We're all trying to, so in plain English, we're all trying to achieve this. We all want to get to that point. How do we do that? And I suppose that's a very long-winded answer in a sense for what are the key issues, but it's not the simplest of things to answer. There are a lot of complexities and nuances there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you've done is you've kind of given us a sort of overarching picture.
Yeah.
While you've been talking, I've been doodling, and I've doodled kind of three rings, the crossover in the middle and the sort of schools on one side and parent carers on the other.
I often represent that to people as a Venn diagram.
As a Venn diagram, and overarching the umbrella of frustration.
Very much, yeah.
So a bit later, we can drill down a little bit into some of those frustrations. I understand the complexity, and it's not something we can address in one interview either, but I appreciate you coming on and opening this up, because it is very frustrating for people on both sides. Well, I would say three sides. There's local authorities as well.
It is. Yeah.
And then the children, obviously. So, so what we'll do is then we'll pause for some ads and music of your choice, and then we'll come back and talk a bit more about you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Evelyn.
With you again, because cause a vision softly creeping left its scenes while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were stabbed the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more, people talking
that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltz know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltz. Part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltz. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello, welcome back, listeners, to Autistic Voices. And before the break, we were talking with Gary Freeman, who is from Leeds area in the UK, and he's a SEND consultant specialist. So we were talking about painting a picture of some of the sort of work that he does around helping schools, local authorities, parents and carers to get a better understanding of each other in terms of the context of where they're coming from, the system, that the whole SEN system as it works today in the UK, and being able to challenge each other in a co-productive way. So and the overarching sort of theme of frustrations that can all bring, which ultimately impacts on the children and the professionals trying to help those children and the parents.
Do you know what it reminds me of? I'm not a big one for quoting people or remembering quotes, but there is one from Tony Benn. And some listeners might not really remember who Tony Benn was. I never always agreed with his politics, but I had tremendous respect for the man because he was so open about them, and he was a very, very articulate, extremely well-educated politician. And what he said, I'll slightly paraphrase, is he said, it's worth having fire in your belly about two things. One is the problems in the world. And the second one is the solutions to those problems. And they have to go together. That unless you have fire in your belly about the solutions, you're pretty much wasting your time if you have the fire about the problems. And I suppose that is what has led me in the last few years to do the work that I do.
Yeah.
And certainly when I retired from a full-time permanent teaching post, it's what led me into consultancy work and advisory work, because I do have that fire in the belly about solutions. So, you know, a phrase that I will often use is, we hear a lot about think outside the boxes. I always say, well, don't think outside the boxes, just tear the boxes up in the first place. So there are none. And it's think radically.
Okay, so talking of that then, how do you feel about what's working? What is working in the system? What doesn't need fixing?
I'm one of the few people who think, and I believe, that fundamentally there's nothing wrong with the system as it is. But where the issues are the interpretation and the practice of that system by the people who do that. Now, whether that's at school level, MAT level, local authority, in some instances, and I can give an example in one in particular, by the DfE, who didn't appear on that occasion to even understand their own legislation, which was fascinating for me. But I do think that's where the issue is. And I think it's the actual outworking of the reforms and the laws that came in 2014 and 15, rather than the statutes themselves. And I know there's a lot of opinion out there, particularly on social media, particularly on Twitter, from people who say, well, the whole system is failing, it's not working. But if you look objectively, it goes back to this, take a step back again, you look at it, it actually is. It's some of the professionals and some of the people in that system who are letting it down and let other people down. And I think there's a very clear distinction between the two, between a systemic problem in terms of what's there and a different type of systemic problem in terms of the people who put it into practice. And I think that's where I tend to try and focus my solutions on. How do we get people to work in a much more collaborative, productive way and achieve what the reforms set out to do? I suppose, in a sense, it's a bit of a misnomer to keep calling them the reforms, because even the most recent ones have been there for 8 years. And I still regularly invoke the Equality Act 2010, the 1996 Education Act, which is 26 years old, of course. So, but that's it for me. It's fundamentally, it's there and it works. It's how it's put into practice that is not working. And a major issue there, and I know this cropped up in the Green Paper, and I know that a lot of the feedback the DfE got was about this. And one of the main issues is accountability in those reforms.
Mm.
Or what happens when people don't do what the reforms say. And I dare say that many people who will listen to this will recognise that in their own experience. But I think that is what needs solutions. Accountability to a lesser extent. I think there is a need to standardise some things, such as EHCP's Education, Health and Care Plan and the format that they have. I think that would certainly help. But it's really for me all about the accountability and that collaborative approach.
Yeah. So going back to what you said earlier about the sort of frustrations that maybe schools have, some yeah. schools, that you think come down to either not having the resources, not having the money, the people, or the actual physical yeah. resources they need to support these children and young people, or they don't know how. So true. Are we talking about training and money? Is that what it comes down to? The frustrations about staff having the right training to be able to support those children effectively and also having the money to put those things in place and that they need? Is that
I think it's three things. It's training, money, and openness of mind.
Okay.
I think openness of mind and that willingness to look at different ways to do things, which don't necessarily cost money, is a key thing.
Yeah.
I follow some people on Twitter, and one of them this week actually listed some very simple, basic things that classroom teachers could do to help children and young people with particular kinds of need. And they pointed out that none of the things that they had listed cost a penny.
Anything. Yeah. I hear this from parents a lot as well. And my yeah. background, well, I worked in special needs education for 6 years. So I was lucky in that I was working at a school who were geared up for putting things in place. So things that just seemed complete common sense to me when I've looked at other provision, some of the provision does it amazingly well. And again, everything's people based. It depends on what people's knowledge is and what their personalities are like and whether they are open-minded and able to think creatively and those sorts of things. So there is a big disparity between how schools yeah. deliver this, isn't there? So is that yeah. when you said about maybe making a bit more standardized, are these resources being put out to schools in terms of, you know, here's a guideline, try these things, this is what works for these types of...
I think sometimes they are.
Yeah.
Sometimes they are. The challenge there is, I think that, so when I said, I'll take a step backwards slightly. When I talked about standardisation, the biggest thing for me that needs standardising is the format of an education, health and care plan. The layout of it, the format, the structure of it. Because then it will be much, much easier for SENCOs and professionals in schools to understand what they need to do. I am told, and again, I have so many meetings every week about this, I was told a couple of days ago by a SENCO, they deal with EHCPs from three different authorities. All three authorities have different formats, radically different.
Yeah.
And it can be very difficult when you've got that kind of difference for children in the same school, in the same year group, and at times even in the same class.
Mm.
It really does pose a challenge to people. The baseline question that you asked is, are those resources being put into schools? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I mean, there isn't a sweeping answer to that. It varies tremendously. And of course, that also depends on whether a child or a young person has special educational needs, but no plan, or special educational needs with a plan.
Yes.
Because
yes.
that can determine the resources, the time, the understanding, the effort that's made.
That comes down to what you said before about accountability, isn't it?
Absolutely it is.
Yeah.
And I find that if I do say again, this I say this a lot to professionals in schools, if they would look at the nature of the special needs support they put for children who do not have a plan, that would almost certainly lead to fewer requests for assessments, hopefully leading to a plan, both by them, in other words, it would save their time and workload, but it would also meet the needs of a child or young person, and by parent, because there wouldn't be that sense of frustration that I come across so often with parents. School isn't doing this, or why can't school do that? And if they would think more carefully about their practice in classrooms, one thing I regularly do and have done for many years is to try and support classroom teachers to look at how they can meet different types of need in the same classroom in a group of children and young people that, that could possibly be quite large. In other words, if you've got two or three different types of need in a class of 20 plus or 30 plus, how do you manage that?
Yeah.
And it's a long way from the old meaning of differentiation, which is different book, different worksheet, and all that, which to me is so outdated, it's irrelevant, and it's completely ineffective. It's about the approach, and the approach doesn't cost anything.
And I'm going to pause you there, just because we need to go to the ads. And
oh, that's fine.
I hate to interrupt people, but if without people paying for advertising, we wouldn't have a show. And it's as simple as that. So we're going to break for the ads and some music, and then we'll come back to you, Gary.
Lovely. Thank you.
We had white horses and ladies by the score, dressed in satin and waiting by the door. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. White lace and feathers, they made up his bed, a gold-covered mattress on which he was led. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. Ooh, what a lucky man he was.
Ooh, what a
The station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, welcome back to Autistic Voices. I'm Evelyn Charmer. I'm speaking with Gary Freeman, who's an SEND or SEND consultant and specialist from the northwest-ish. Northeast.
Northeast-ish.
Is it that? I think of, because it's west of me. I guess. So let me say again. Okay. So I'm speaking with Gary Freeman. He's an SEND, SEND consultant and specialist in the Northeast around Leeds. But I understand you work further afar, you know, further afield than the Leeds area, Gary. Is that right?
Absolutely, it is. I work all over England.
Yeah. Sorry, one of the things that came up before when I spoke to another SEND consultant on one of my shows was that you were talking about local authorities doing things differently. And I work with children and families a lot as a therapist who have got children out of school because of various reasons to do with these issues. And one of the things might be they've moved from one local authority to another to find a school that provides what their child needs, and then found that the local authority refused the placement at the last minute, or they have to challenge an appeal, so that child's still out of school for some time. That's one of the issues that comes to me, and I imagine you as well. And also, just like you said, the way that different local authorities do these things very differently, even the look of the education healthcare plan is very different.
I totally agree.
How it's written and how it should be interpreted. So it is really hard for the one of the families I'm working with at the moment have got a problem where the EHCP that they've been using for their child for several years isn't valid at all in the new local authority that they've moved to up the road. So they're having to kind of start the process again, really, which is
I won't get drawn into the legalities of that, but I could say a great deal about that.
Yeah, I'm just giving examples for people listening of the sorts of things that are common, because for some of our listeners, they might be going through some of these things and think, oh gosh, this is really a struggle for me, but it's not just you. And these are really common things, aren't they?
They are. And it does go back to the point I made about accountability as well.
Yeah. Did you want to expand on that, or are you just going to leave that there?
Well, the example you gave, and I do see this as well, when parents move across local authority boundaries, they move home, or they move their child out of area to a different school.
Yeah.
It can happen in both. It's about that transfer of provision. It particularly happens when parents move home.
Yes.
And they go to a different area. That transfer of provision. Now, there's a very, very clear system set down in law for that. And it's a very ethical one. It isn't applied all the time by local authorities.
Yeah, and the example I gave isn't standard. It's not everybody's experience.
Absolutely.
And I want to make that clear. So don't think if you move house, it does vary. And there are some who have very smooth transitions and local authorities pick up from where you were. So just to make that really clear, listeners, if you do move local authority or you're planning to, don't be panicking that you're going to fall through the net like that. But there are people who have that experience.
True. I would always advise parents to contact the local authority in the area they're moving into.
Yes.
And begin those conversations as soon as possible.
Yes. Okay. So going back to local authorities then, just a quick question. You can say yes or no if you want to, or you can tell us a bit more. Do you believe yourself, your own opinion, that local authorities fulfil their legal and ethical obligations?
Overall, no. Having said that, I think to be fair, there are some authorities in all corners of England that genuinely do try.
Mm-hmm.
And I think within those, there are many, many local authority officers who try even harder.
Yeah. And I've come across many myself.
Oh, absolutely I do.
Yeah.
They are very caring professionals and they want to try and get it right.
Yeah. And I do think the system's improved probably since you started all those 43 years ago as well. And we are working always to improve. I say we as a whole because I'm not working within the legal system or anything, but you know, even the way that I work with young people who are in the system and in school systems and things has changed as well. So I try to work in a much more co-productive way. I get involved with educational healthcare planning and reviewing for children that I work with therapeutically because I think it's really important to look at the work that's happening for that child and family and any plans to resolve issues that are maybe whether it's in school or not. And I try to, I do liaise. If I'm working with a child with additional needs as a therapist, I liaise with that child's education provider.
It's why I try and get as many schools as possible, particularly SENCO, as we're talking about here, to sort of open their doors to professionals.
Yeah. I find that it's been really, really positive, actually. But often it's been me, knowing my background's in education, in special education, it's often been me approaching the schools to say, I'm here and I can help with this and can I come too? You know, and it's the same with looked after children, I also attend, you know, social work review meetings and things like that, because it's all about that joined up thinking. And I find that when I offer that, no one ever says no, thank you. People are always open.
They are.
People are always very happy to have another view or another person to support the team around the family. And so don't be afraid if you're out there working slightly outside of schools with children and people to get involved in the wider context of their life.
I couldn't agree more. And it is what I'm constantly saying to all the professionals, all the sort of, to use that word, stakeholders involved in this whole process, to work together and to understand the different perspectives that each one has got.
Yeah.
But we all contribute to the same thing in the end. And it is about a team of professionals around a child, a family, a young person.
Yes. And I find the outcomes are so much better and
absolutely,
more transformational over a longer period of time for a young person.
Very much so. That.
Yeah, thank you for agreeing with me. I'm glad we're on the same page.
No, I genuinely do. Yeah.
So just a last question for you, Gary, is about SENCOs. Now, SENCO stands for Special Educational Needs Coordinators.
Yeah.
Right. So some of our listeners might not have realised that or know what they do. Can you give us a brief view of what a SENCO does in a school or a MAT, multi-agency trust?
Interestingly, when you defined it, the last bit, coordinator, I think a key thing for me is that they coordinate all the special educational needs and disabilities provision in a school. They don't have to do it all.
Yes,
so I say to SENCOs, I say to heads, to parents, to governors, just remember that the role is SENCO, not SENDO. They are a SEN-coordinator, not the doer. It's impossible for one person to do the whole thing. To go back to 1977 when I began, then it was, because what tended to happen was that the SENCO in most schools had a little room somewhere, and children with any kind of issues or challenges or difficulties would be, go see the SENCO.
Right.
Send them down there. That's impossible now because schools have grown, generally grown in size. And the role is a coordination one.
Yes.
It's about understanding the SEND world and enabling others to do the same, supporting professionals in schools. So supporting SENCO will support colleagues in schools. That can be just with simple information. It can be with approaches and teaching style and pedagogy. It can be that. It can be supporting the understanding and the practice of school leaders. Mm. And I include middle leaders, not just senior leaders. Middle leaders are often the key people.
Absolutely.
It can include working with governors or local boards in the case of academies. It will include bridging that gap between school and local authority. And to go back to this idea of three groups again that we talked about earlier, is to bring together schools, local authority, and parents and families. And that's the role of a SENCO. Yes, there are guidelines and principles in the code of practice. Yes, they are repeated in the Children and Families Act and the SEND regs. They all mean fundamentally the same thing.
Yeah.
They define an ethical, principled role as a leader in a school. And that's what a SENCO is. They are a leader in their school.
Now, the last thing to say on that then, before we close the show, it's a nice one to end on, actually, because leadership is the word for me. And it doesn't happen in every school by any means. But in my opinion, I've seen it work so much better when the SENCO is on the senior leadership team of a school. Some schools call it a senior management team. Some call it a senior leadership team. But the leadership team are usually any assistant or deputy head teachers, anybody who's head of something. So heads of safeguarding, head of pastoral support, that sort of thing. And when you have a SENCO around that table, with those, having those discussions with the heads of safeguarding, heads of pastoral, etc., they're getting a much bigger picture of the child's experience actually in school, and they're not just sitting on the phone talking to local authorities all day. And also, the rest of the senior leadership team, in my experience, really benefit from having the SENCO there as well on in those meetings where important decisions are made about leading the school in terms of resources, in terms of how things work, even in terms of which children go in which classes, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So I'm just going to leave that there.
That's my experience as well.
Oh, fantastic. And just out, if you're listening out there and you're in a school and you've got a SENCO and they're not on your senior leadership team, I think it's something to think about because it makes a massive difference.
It does. Absolutely agree.
Thank you. Well, thank you for your time today, Gary.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I know you've been extremely busy and I've been trying to get you on the show for several weeks and I keep knocking on your door going, are you going to come on this week? And we've finally got you here. So
it's a pleasure and I've enjoyed it.
So yes, thank you. And just, have you got any advice for parents and carers out there of managing, you know, the transition back in to school and college at the moment?
I think it's about trying to work with people and listening to everybody's views. And I know that parents can say, well, school should listen to my views. True. But if we all listen, it tends to have that knock-on effect on others. One person listening will lead to someone else listening. So it's about listening and that willingness to listen for me.
Oh, well, good luck, everybody out there, with wherever you're at with this. And if anybody wanted to get in touch with you, Gary, what's the best way?
I think if you just look out for me on Twitter, and the handle is @gfreeman2012.
@gfreeman2012 on Twitter. And, of course, when your show goes out, I'll be promoting it as well through the usual channels. So thank you very much for your time. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you again.
Have a great weekend.
Yeah. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Thank you for listening. I'm Evelyn Charmer. This is Autistic Voices on UK Health Radio. And special thanks to our guest of the week.